Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Kaneko Great Minds Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by humanitarian and former mountaineer Greg Mortensen, author of Three Cups of Tea and Stones into Schools. The topic of his talk will be Promoting Peace Through Education. Mr. Mortensen's appearance is sponsored by Warren Distribution in partnership with the Phoenix Academy Day School, a nonprofit private school, kindergarten through eighth grade, for students who are experiencing difficulty learning to read, write, and spell the English language. They offer small class sizes and a strong phonics-based program to give students the tools they need to learn to read and write in order to be successful. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, January 14, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Kaneko, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Kaneko Executive Director Hal France.
Creativity takes many forms and addresses many things. Artistic creativity is a catalyst for how we see the world, but most creativity in the world is focused on finding solutions. Our special guest, Greg Mortensen, is a powerful example of what can happen when people are able to harness their energies with common goals and accomplish great things. The person I'm going to introduce now shares some important things in common with our special guest, Greg Mortensen. He has played an increasingly important role in resolving the conflicts in Central Asia and Afghanistan. A frequent presenter on aspects of U.S. relations with Afghanistan and Pakistan, terrorism, and human rights before committees of both houses of the U.S. Congress. He speaks Dari, Afghan Persian, Farsi, Iranian Persian, and Tajiki Persian. For 40 years, he has lived, worked, and studied Afghanistan as a Peace Corps volunteer in Kabul, Fulbright Fellow, and then as Executive Director of the Fulbright Foundation of Afghanistan. He is responsible for bringing in-depth and important information about the region of this region of the world to our community and the University of Nebraska system. Please join me in welcoming the distinguished Dean of International Studies and Programs at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and the University of Nebraska Medical Center and the Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. Please welcome Tom Gutierrez.
Thank you very much, Hal. You could have left the bit about the 40 years out, however. Getting older, and I'm a little more sensitive about that. I want, before I go into the introduction, to also join with others in commending Warren Distribution and Bob Schlott for the leadership and the contributions to make this event possible. And I also want to say what everybody else here understands, and that is we all really appreciate the leadership that the Kaneko provides to our community in cultural and educational programming, making Omaha, not only as Forbes revealed today, the most livable place in terms of cost effectiveness in the United States, but also a very rich community in which to live culturally and educationally. So I've enjoyed working very much with Hal France and his fellow members of the Kaneko in the past on other programs relating to Afghanistan, and look forward to doing that again in the future. When Hal asked me to introduce Greg Mortensen, I thought, well, geez, that should be a pretty easy job, right? I mean, who doesn't know everything there is to know about this guy who's had these books on the New York and every other best-selling and best-read book list in the whole world? One of those books has been on that list for more than 200 weeks, so, and now there's another one on that, so I don't really have to say much about the guy himself. And it's kind of unique because I've been hearing about him and hearing about him, particularly from a guy in this audience by the name of Don Hamill, for so many years, and he was trying to get us together. We never were able to make it, and so this is the first day we've actually met each other, and I'm not done, okay? And so this is the first day that we've actually met each other, and we're very pleased, I think, both of us to have had that opportunity now, because I think we do have at least the opportunity, we've had the opportunity to share a deep interest in the people from two countries, in particular Afghanistan and Pakistan, that really need the interest of all of us, if all of us are going to profit into the future. One of the things that I particularly was struck by in reading Three Cups of Tea was just the title, because it means so much. It means so much in Afghanistan, the whole concept of spending time with each other. Afghans pride themselves on their hospitality, so do Pakistanis in the same way. Tea is so important to the way they can provide that hospitality. It's not very much, but it's important for them. And to be able to have three cups of tea, as you read in the book, means a very, very important step towards forming relationships. In Afghanistan, there are other phrases like that. One that goes, Yak roz didi dost, digar roz didi birader, which is the first day you meet your friends, the next day you meet your brothers. And it's, again, very much bespeaks the whole importance of relationships in the societies in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So I'm not going to recount all those things. You don't want to hear me up here. You want to hear Greg Mortensen. And if you want all those specific things, you can go to the internet and you can read those books if you haven't read them. But I do want to say a couple things, and that is this. I was struck today by one thing that I learned about him that I admire greatly, and that was the work of his father at Kilimanjaro in Africa, in setting up a hospital in which he focused primarily on ensuring that the people who were going to be serviced by that hospital were also the people who were going to be running that hospital. So it wasn't a hospital led and run by expatriates. It was a hospital led and run by those his father was able to train. And this is a principle that we've tried to follow at the Center for Afghanistan Studies. And as you all know from his books, that's what Greg Mortensen has been the bellwether for in so many programming activities in Pakistan and Afghanistan. I think more than anything else, he understands that the most important part of what needs to be done in that part of the world and everywhere else in order to attack those root causes of terrorism is to do it in a people-to-people approach. It's much more valuable than any other way in which we can provide assistance. And I think that any of us who have had the opportunity to read his books and have been following him understand that Greg Mortensen really is an exemplary individual in terms of the work he's done in that way. And so with that, let's bring him to the podium and hear him, as we all came here to do. So I present to you Greg Mortensen.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks. Thank you. First of all, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Well, again, I'd like to thank the Phoenix Academy and all the kids. It was incredibly inspiring today to be with lots of the kids from many schools, and I'm really, when you go into a community and you meet the kids first, I think that's a really great way to go into the community. So thanks to all the students and the kids. I'd like to also thank Kaneko and the wonderful vision you've had to bring. We had a forum with many of the community leaders here today, and we were able to see and discuss many things, and it was mostly about involving the community and how we can make things and make a difference and have role models. So that was very inspiring. And Bob Schlott, thank you, and Warren Distribution, thank you very much, Bob, for making all this happen. And I also, Tom, thank you, but also Mary Lou, your beautiful wife, who's really the rock of, I hope so, family, thanks. It's great to meet you. And it was so exciting to meet Tom today, and we're looking forward to working together with partnership, in, especially with teacher training, which you do so well and have given such a great, was it about 9,000 student, 9,000 teachers have been gone through teacher training because of somebody here in your community. And Dick Holland, thank you very much for what you've done for education. He says he's going to start, he has started a revolution in early childhood education development. So everybody, there's a very big elder here who can change the face of the world with early childhood development. So you're going to get started right now. Okay, all right. We're going to light the candles. And Rhea and June, thank you for the gift of your vision through art and through expression, and also for some very wonderful tea today and for a very peaceful time amidst everything else. Thank you so much. Tashakur, I'd like to also thank UNO and the Center for Afghan Studies and all of you here who are with that, and Peru, the university. And thank you to Hal France for being the guide today and cheerleader for everything. And I also like to thank the Kalenda family, whose son is one of our great contemporary military leaders, and for the vision that came from a family here in Nebraska. And Don Hamill, who's kind of our number one cheerleader for 15 years in Omaha, thank you. And also my nephew, Jake Brown, who's here, so it's always nice to go somewhere and have some family. So I'd like to thank also all the educators and the teachers and administrators, the veterans, all the civic groups, you know, I won't start naming all of them, but you know all of them, and to all the community, just wonderful. I'm just so grateful and honored to be here. When I talked to the students today, and we talked a lot about education, and one of the things that struck me as I asked the students, which are from 14 schools, how many of you have been involved in any kind of community service? And this is elementary school all the way through high school. And about two-thirds, 60% of the hands came up. Now, generally, it's a lot less than that. And I think for all of you in Omaha, that's something you can really celebrate. You should be very proud of that you're the students here. You know, there's obviously lots of problems in education, but that's one thing that you have. The only other place that I've been in hundreds of cities where I've seen that kind of response with kids is in Topeka, Kansas. So maybe it's the Midwest, or I don't know what it is, but so I'd like to really, you probably are aware, very aware of this, but I'd like to really encourage that you support your community service and service learning and civic engagement, all those wonderful things that you're doing in so many of your schools. There are about 128 million children in the world who are not in school. About 78 million of those are female. And if we wanted to, we could eradicate global literacy in the next 12 years. And the investment, you know, we call it might call it bailout, but you invest in education. The investment would be about $6 billion a year for 12 years. Now, that sounds like a lot of money, but it's about $5 to $10 per child per month we could eradicate global literacy. In West Africa, there are hundreds of thousands of kids who harvest cocoa. Cocoa grows in a little pod in a tree. You hit it with a stick, it falls down, and you crack it open with a machete. But then you have to gingerly pry open the cocoa to produce the 3 million tons of extract made to use chocolate in the world today. In Congo, previously Sierra Leone or Burundi or Rwanda, Angola, there are tens of thousands of children who are forced at a very young age to become soldiers, and they're taught to do very horrific things. If you teach a child how to do those things before they mature, their conscience doesn't understand the difference between life and death. The next time you pick up a soccer ball or football, look at it, it'll probably say made in Pakistan. There's a place called Sialkot, where many of the world's soccer balls are made. But if you look at very closely, you'll see very fine stitches sewn together on the little felt patches. Again, most of those are made by children. And child slavery was abolished in Pakistan in 2004. What happened is it went underground and it's still very prevalent today. China, the same with fireworks. In Cambodia, 100,000 kids work in rice paddies for hours a day. They don't get $4 pair of rubber boots, so they get foot rot and fungus. Perhaps the biggest, I think, travesty is that even today, modern-day society, there are millions of children who are modern-day slaves. It's more rampant than any time in history. So I'd like to introduce you to a modern-day slave. His name is Abdul, and Abdul is from Pul Qumri. I met him in 2005. We were driving down the road, and our radiator blew up, so we coasted into a local garage or gas station, and I asked for a mechanic, and out jumps Abdul. He's maybe 12 years old. He's covered in grease and oil, And very quickly, in 2 hours, he fixed our radiator. Amazing mechanic. And then as I started talking to Abdul, I said, how come you're not in school? And he actually explained that he was an orphan. And he had been bought and sold. And he worked 12 hours a day, more than that. He didn't get any pay. He just got food. And he got to sleep under a truck unmolested. So I promised Abdul, I said, in a month, we'll be back from our rounds, and we're going to help you out. We got back there a few weeks later, and I was so excited to see Abdul, but he had disappeared. So our staff, we spent 2 days looking for him, but we couldn't find him. And every time we go through Polkomri, we try to find Abdul, but he's disappeared and gone into the abyss. So I have his picture on my desk to remind me there's absolutely no reason why any child in this world today should be a slave. There's no reason why every single child on this planet should have their right to go to school. Well, I wrote this book called Three Cups of Tea. Anybody here know what three cups of tea means? My daughter, Amira, she's 14. She can rap what three cups of tea means. Now, I'm not going to embarrass myself here. You know some kids here. You probably like to see me rap, huh? But the first cup, you're a stranger. The second cup, a friend. And the third cup, you become family. What some of you might not know about, though, is the subtitle. When I submitted the original manuscript to the publisher in New York, I picked the title, but they picked the subtitle. They said it's going to be One Man's Mission to Fight Terrorism One School at a Time. Now, although I'm a military veteran, I was very opposed to that because they said the reason I do this is to promote peace. Well, they disagreed with me, so finally I went to New York, and this is my first time in Manhattan. Pretty scary, you know, for a little guy or big guy from Montana or whatever. And I summoned a jirga, it's like a tribal conference, and I said, you have to change the subtitle to One Man's Mission to Promote Peace. Well, they said, Greg, this is your first book, and son, you need to learn a couple things about the publishing industry. Only one out of eight books makes a profit, and two-thirds of all bestsellers are pre-chosen by the publisher. So we'd like to promote your book, but you have to be fighting terrorism so we can pitch the media, and then your book will do just fine. Well, finally I conceded, but if you work in Pakistan or Afghanistan or maybe even Omaha for a while, you never settle a deal without driving a hard bargain on the side. So I said, if this book doesn't do well, please change the subtitle to One Man's Mission to Promote Peace One School at a Time. So the book came out in 2006, and for a year it didn't do very well. So the publisher, in January 2007, they decided to change the book to subtitle One Man's Mission to Promote Peace One School at a Time. And now for 205 weeks, it's been a New York Times bestseller. So, it's also in the military. Many of the military commanders, and it's reading in many of the military different places. This is General David Petraeus. He's the CENTCOM commander, and he read Three Cups of Tea about 3 years ago, and he asked me if I could come and talk to his troops. And now, being a military general, so I went down to Fort MacDill, and I spent some time talking to him, and he said, being a military general, there are three bullet points that he had extracted from the book that he'd like to impart with the troops. And these are General Petraeus' three bullet points. Number one, that we need to listen more. And by listening, he didn't mean just listen. He said to look at a perspective from the other person's situation. Number two, respect. And I asked General Petraeus, what do you mean by respect? He said it actually means humility. And we are there to serve the good people of that country. That is to be our objective. And number three, to build relationships. So today, it's per Secretary Gates. It's mandatory for all senior military commanders, counterinsurgency courses, and many other places. Well, I was, as Tom mentioned, I was, you know, if you want to label me, I'm a Minnesota Norwegian Lutheran. I was born in 57. Well, there's a few of us out there. Garrison Keillor, he's not here. I was born in 57, but when my parents were 3 months old, they went to Tanzania to teach in a girls' school. And subsequently, my father decided to start a hospital on the slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro. The first thing, though, that he insisted on is vision, that it would be a teaching hospital, not just to help people, but to teach people about health care and education. He also insisted that local people be in charge. Now, that didn't go very well with many of the Westerners. They said, you have to have a qualified Westerner if you want to run this hospital. But my father always made Africans in charge. Well, finally, in 1971, the hospital opened up, and my father, during the commencement speech with Julius Nyerere, visionary leader of Tanzania, he said, first he congratulated the people, this is your hospital, we're so proud of you. And then he said, I predict that in 10 years, all of the department heads, the KCMC hospital will be from Tanzania. Well, basically, my father got fired within a couple months for having the audacity to believe this hospital could be run by Africans. So we came back to the States, and unfortunately, my father died from cancer in his mid-40s. But 10 years later, in 1981, we got the annual report from KCMC Hospital, and every single department head was from Tanzania. They were trained and from Tanzania. And the important lesson is that, you know, we all have an innate desire to help people. It's either, you know, because of our conscience or intuition or faith or whatever it is, sometimes even guilt. But if we really want to help people, we have to empower people. There's a very big difference between helping and empowering. And empowering and empowerment begins with education. Well, in Africa, I learned a proverb. And if the gentleman, you can bear with me for 1 second here. It says, if we educate a boy, we educate an individual. But if we educate a girl, we educate a community. So how do the gentlemen feel about this? How do the women and all the girls feel about this? I think we're a little bit outnumbered here. So how this began was in 1992, my sister Krista, she very beautiful sister, but she had severe epilepsy. She never complained. She was very inspiring. And she saw the baseball movie called Field of Dreams. It takes place in a cornfield in Dyersville, Iowa. So for her 23rd birthday, she was going to go see that school. And so she packed her bags. But when my mother went to wake up Krista, July 24th, 1992, Krista died in her sleep from a very massive seizure. And it was very devastating. So at the time, I was a graduate student studying neurophysiology or epilepsy. I also working at trauma nurse. So I was climbing. So I decided to climb K2, the world's second highest mountain, and put Krista's amber necklace on top of K2 to honor her memory. A year later, in 93, I went to Pakistan. This is the Karakoram or Karakoram mountain range. It's the greatest consolidation of high peaks in the world. There are 64 peaks above 23,000 feet in a 100-mile area. So what freeway is going up to Sioux Falls or Sioux City from here? I-90? 29? Okay. Next time you go down I-29, clock yourself 5 miles and then pretend you're going straight up. And that's how high this mountain is. Now, in Boston, I told this to the people there, and afterwards they came up to me afterwards and said, you know, in Boston, all the freeways go in circles, so we can't figure that out here in Boston. We spent 83 days on K2. It was a lot of hard work. I didn't quite succeed. My two partners did somewhat. So coming off the mountain, I felt I was exhausted, emaciated, but most of all, I felt as if I let my sister down. Now, anybody here, can you remember, how many of you read Three Cups of Tea first? Okay. All right. Now, can anybody here remember what the first chapter is called in Three Cups of Tea? Oh, very good. Who's that? Okay. Give him a big round. Failure. Oh, he actually looked at the book just now. Okay. you know, sometimes there's 12,000 people. Usually a kid can remember that word, but adults, we don't like that word. And actually, when I submitted the original manuscript to the publisher in Penguin, New York, they said, Greg, you never start a book with the word failure in the U.S. Well, you know what? We all make mistakes, and we all fail. Some of us fail in our investments. Some of us, you know, I was in Wall Street last year, and I mentioned that some of us fail investments. Nobody laughed there. Some of us fail in our relationships or in this country. Only 78% of kids who start first grade will graduate from high school in the United States of America. There are many things that we don't succeed in. So the next time you fail or I fail, think of this very beautiful Persian proverb. It says, when it is dark, you can see the stars. So we left K2. It was about an 80-mile walk over 5 days. I stumbled into a little village called Corfe. When I got there, there was a very elderly, stout, stern man with a silver beard. He's the Nirmadhar, or the village chief. And his name was Haji Ali. And this village is called Corfe. First, he said, Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be with you, in the salutation, Islamic salutation. Then he said, Chizale. Now, being from the Midwest, The best translation I can think of the word chisele is what the heck. Because I was weather-beaten, my pants were ripped in half, and I hadn't taken a bath in about 85 days. So he said, first, before you come to my village, you do need to wash up and have a cup of tea. So I've now spent, this is the 17th year working in rural Pakistan, Afghanistan. I've spent about 78 months in the field. I haven't got to four decades yet, Tom. And there's hope, right? Okay. In a village like Corfe, if you go into some villages in Afghanistan, Pakistan, rural villages, one out of three children born dies before the age of one. The infant mortality rate is staggering. The literacy rate in some areas is non-existent. Also, we did a study in Corfe of the women in Corfe, the hemoglobin level, it's the red blood cell count level. Now, most of the women there had a hemoglobin of 8 to 9. Most of the women here, your hemoglobin is 12 or 14. If you had a hemoglobin of 8, you'd be going to one of your fine hospitals to get a pint of blood. The reason the women are anemic is because the men eat most of the protein, the eggs, the meat, and they don't share with the women. These women are not only childbearing women, but they're living at altitude, so it's very debilitating when you know they don't have that adequate protein and nutrition. Well, one day, people were so hospitable, that is probably the greatest asset of the people in these communities, is their hospitality and their honor and their dignity. And one day I walked behind the village, I saw about 84 kids sitting in the dirt. There are about 4 girls and the rest are boys. Most of the kids were riding with a stick in the sand. And although I'd seen a lot of poverty in Africa, when I saw those kids, it really touched me now. And for the kids here, I'd like to give you a little assignment. Sometime, even in the wintertime, go outside for about 5 or 10 minutes and do your math or writing with a stick in the sand. See what it feels like. Millions of children in the world today, that's how they get their education, with a stick in the sand. Well, I spent some time, I was so amazed, and one day a young girl named Chocho came up to me and she said, could you help us build a school? So I promised, I said, I'll help you build a school and we'll help you also, what's most important is to get teachers and education. Today we are trying to solve and grapple with something called poverty. But the only way we can cure or help poverty is to touch poverty and to taste poverty, to smell poverty, to hear poverty, to be with poverty. We can never solve poverty from a think tank in Washington, D.C. And to me, that is one of the greatest virtues of our great country. So we have this incredible philanthropic spirit and also community service. Kids are going out to the communities. There was a U.S. News and World Report study that came out 4 years ago, and it said that in 1990, 18% of college graduates said, I want to go out and make the world a better place. Today, 50% of college graduates say, I want to make my community or the world a better place. And if you go down into the high schools community and the elementary schools here in Omaha or anywhere, you'll find it's much higher than that. And it's not just about serving or going out and helping your community. It teaches us as Americans to think of ourselves as a collective community, just as the children in Afghanistan or Pakistan, that we're all part of it. And we're only as strong as our weakest link. And I think that is something, again, that we can celebrate here in Omaha. Well, I made a promise to build a school. I came back to the States. Cost about $12,000, I figured, so I had no clue how to fundraise, and I had a lot of flack for that. But what I did is I went to the local library. Are there any librarians in here? Okay, let's give the librarians all a big round. Thank you. You are my heroes. All right. So the librarians, they decided, we looked up the name of 580 celebrities and movie stars and sports heroes, and in 93 I was computer literate. So over 10 weeks, I hand-typed 580 letters. Dear Michael Jordan, dear Sylvester Stallone, dear Oprah, I need some help. But guess what happened? Nothing happened. Then at Christmas time, I got one check back from Tom Brokaw for $100. Now, Tom has recently moved to Montana, and we've had a few evenings together. And Tom says, Greg, everywhere I go, people pull me aside and ask me about 3 cups of tea, but I'm really embarrassed because I only wrote you a $100 check. Now, and you wrote about it. Now, I didn't quite have the guts to say, Tom, I'm still going to write another book, so could you give us another check, and we'll write about it and stick it in the book. But sorry, Tom, the book's already out now, but he really got this going. So what happened then is I kept persisting. I then sold my car. I sold my climbing gear, my cash in my retirement policy. I didn't have very much, but I sold everything I had. And by springtime, I had to raise about $3,800. My mother is an elementary school principal in Wisconsin. She invited me to come and talk to the kids. And heaven forbid you go to an elementary school to get any help. Anyways, I spent 2 days there. It was really inspiring. When I got done, there was a fourth grader. His name was Jeffrey. And he came up to me and said, I have a piggy bank at home, and I'm going to help you. And I thought, what can a fourth grader do? Anyway, 6 weeks later, Westside School raised 62,340 pennies. It was the biggest check I'd ever received. And when you think about it, it wasn't celebrities, wasn't movie stars, wasn't sports heroes, it wasn't adults, but children reaching out to children halfway around the world, and they did it with the pennies. And, you know, what can a penny do? Pretty much nothing. But in Afghanistan and Pakistan, a penny can buy a pencil. And a pencil really is nothing, or a brick. But what education does, though, is it gives a person hope and empowers people. And the kids today ask me, what is the most inspiring thing I see? Well, it's that moment I've witnessed thousands of times. It's the first time when a child, we get them to come to school, we teach them how to write their name. It might be in Pashto or Dari or English. When a child can write their name, all of a sudden they have an identity, and they belong, and they're empowered, and it's really, you know, those of your parents, you know what that feels like. So today we have a program called Pennies for Peace, and for lack of better words, it's kind of going bananas lately. 3 years ago it was in about 280 schools, and now it's in 5,400 schools around this country and 24 other countries in the world. When I go to marketing or business schools, they say, what's your marketing program? We don't have any. This is totally run by kids. There's only less than one full-time employee running this whole program. But what Pennies for Peace does is now we teach about philanthropy, caring, sharing. We also have, it teaches kids about cultural sensitivity, about the importance of bilingual education. We also, the importance of listening and learning from your elders. There's a component there. And we last year, the NEA approved the curriculum through the Rubik standardized system, so it would be integrated into the schools in the U.S. The other thing, we encourage kids to go out on their own, do something in their own community or in the U.S. or around the world. The thing that we never predicted is when kids get going on this, they get on fire. So I have thousands of examples. I whittled down to one for this evening. This young man, his name is Zach Bonner. He's from Tampa, Florida. He is 13 years old. He started Pennies for Peace when he was 8, but a couple years later, he saw some homeless kids in the Tampa area. And his best friend had trouble learning how to read and write. And kids used to taunt his friend, so he decided, I'm going to do something. So he started an organization called Little Red Wagon Foundation. 2 years ago, Zach walked from Tampa to Washington, D.C., and he raised $78,000 to bring awareness to homeless kids in the U.S. Last summer, Zach walked. He didn't fly, he didn't drive, he didn't go on a horse. He walked from Tampa across the United States of America to Los Angeles. He raised over $1 million to bring awareness to homeless kids in the U.S. You know, he's 13. So, and his parents are like, what got into our child? I thought we were just, you know, they have nothing to do with this. This is all his thing. Well, when Zach set up his foundation, he called me up. He wanted to know about board directors. Are these like board people or adults? And I said, no, that's like a moral compass and fiduciary response. You got to have board directors. And Zach said, could I put some kids on my board? I said, well, check the law in Florida. There's no law in Florida against it. So all of Zach's board directors have to be under 18 years of age to be on Little Red Wagon Foundation board. So, well, we kept working and working in Pakistan to get this school built. I made a lot of mistakes. I had a lot of difficulties. But the biggest problem, it actually wasn't them, and it was me. And I was doing something that we call micromanagement. I had my plumb line, receipts, and records, and I was determined to get this school built. And one day, Haji Ali, he noticed my frustration, came up to me and said, if you really want to get a school built, get an education here, you have to sit down and be quiet and let us do the work. Not only that, he took my receipt, he took my records, he took my plumb line, he locked them up, he came back and said, there, don't you worry, everything will be just fine, you know, have trust, inshallah, Allah willing. Of course, I was horrified. Guess what happened 6 weeks later? The school got built. And Then he brought me a ledger. It's an old British accounting system for illiterate people with the thumbprint. They had accounted for every single rupee that had gone into that building. So, and this lesson can also, you know, this is a micro scale, but you can also apply this on a macro scale. One of my biggest concerns or criticisms of the original reconstruction policy in Afghanistan, we started the Bonn Conference in 2001, all these big donor countries got together and they pledged to rebuild the country. Now, a third of the, two-thirds of pledges didn't even get there. But the biggest problem is it was a very centralized, deprovincialized type of system. Now, some of you here, you're around after World War II. There's something called the Marshall Plan. And I think the Marshall Plan, it was a brilliant plan. And the architects were genius. But the main component of the Marshall Plan is it was provincialized and decentralized. In Afghanistan, we completely flipped that around. It only lasted 3 or 4 years. Really started to understand. I think, I also feel the best program in that country today is called the National Solidarity Program. It's where the federal Afghan government takes about 2% of its national budget. They write checks to all of the 394 districts. It's like for 200,000, be like here, a congressional district. And that community decides what they want to do with the money. They also have to match quite a bit of sweat equity. And it's totally run by Afghans. There's nobody else. There's some consultants, but it's totally run by Afghans. And so it's probably, I don't know if you agree, Tom, but I think it's one of the best programs there. And if you go in these rural areas, that's what you'll see is a national solidarity little water well, irrigation ditch, or something the community has done entirely on their own. Well, the more I do this, you know, I'm convinced education has to be our top national and international priority, and including education for girls. And we can, why do you believe in that? It's, we can drop bombs, we can build roads, we can put electricity, we can put in computers, but unless kids, especially girls, are educated, society will never change. So why is educating girls so important? Of course, we have to educate the guys, but educating girls has profound impacts in any society. Educating girls has some of the things that happen are, number one, it reduces infant mortality. Number two, reduce the population explosion. Three, it improves the quality of health and life itself. When a girl learns how to read and write, she often teaches her mother how to read and write. Boys, we don't do that quite as much. You also see kids coming home from the bazaar. They have meat or vegetables wrapped in newspaper. And then the mother very carefully unfolds a newspaper and asks her daughter to read the news to her. It's very powerful when a woman can read the news and understand what's going on in the world around her. Number two, I think is especially important too about population. You know, we have a lot of problems in this planet today. We have environmental problems, we have disasters, we have wars. One of the biggest problems though is there's simply too many people on this planet, especially if you look in 3 to 5 generations. The number one way to reduce population without doing anything else is mainly female literacy. The best example is Bangladesh in Southeast Asia. After the civil war, the partition was with Pakistan, in 1970, Bangladesh decided to put about 8% of their GDP into education. In Pakistan today, it's been less than 2% for decades. And in Bangladesh, 40 years ago, the female literacy rate was less than 20%, and today it's tripled. And the average woman in Bangladesh 40 years ago had about 9 live births. The average woman today has 2.8 live births. And one of the biggest reasons for that is simply female literacy. You know, if you have 9 kids, then there's 81 grandkids. If you have 3 kids, then there's 9 grandkids. You can keep going down the road with that. Also, women who are educated are much less likely to encourage or condone their son to get into violence or into terrorism or into gangs. The higher education a woman has them. And I've seen that in so many cases. The Taliban, some of their primary recruiting grounds are illiterate, impoverished society because many educated women, even at risk of their lives, refuse to allow their son to get into violence or into terrorism. So I have some bad news and some good news. The bad news is, in the last 4 years, there's been over 2,400 and even much more schools bombed, burned, or destroyed or shut down by the Taliban or militants. What's interesting, though, is two-thirds or more of those schools are girls' schools. So why do a group of big bad men armed with Kalashnikovs, why are they so terrified of a little girl going to school? I mean, what's the big deal? Why do you poison her? Why do you throw stones at her? Why do you throw battery acid at her face? Why do you threaten her and make force her to work? I think it's because their greatest fear, it's not a bullet, but it's a pen. And what they fear the most is if that girl gets an education, grows up, becomes a mother, the value of education will go on in their society. And here's the good news. And a lot of this, UNO and Tom were really instrumental in introducing a really good curriculum and quality education in Afghanistan. 10 years ago, there were about 800,000 children in school in that country. It was at the height of the Taliban, and they're mostly boys. Today, there are about 8 million children going to school in that country, and 2.5 million are female. This is the greatest increase in school enrollment in any country in modern history. So how many of you knew about this before I just told you right now? Let's see. There we go. Where did you hear about it? In the pamphlet, okay. Anybody else? You know, I've asked half a million people this question last year. Only a few dozen hands have come up. I was briefing 5 U.S. senators on Capitol Hill last year, and I told them this, and they started patting themselves on the back, bipartisan. And I said, how can you take credit for something you don't even know about? Well, that's a politician for you. Now, of course we deserve credit. I mean, the U.S., yes, we've had a big role in this. But the real driving force, the reason those kids are in school, it's because their mothers, their parents, and communities, more than anything, what they want is education. This is Admiral Mike Mullen. He's the Chairman, Joint Chief of Staff. He also read through cups of tea. And by the way, I'm talking about 3 military people today, but none of them told me their wives read the book first. So, and said, honey, you ought to check this out. So let's give a big round to the wives, sisters, daughters, mothers, women's book clubs for all you do. So Admiral Mullen read 3 cups of tea. This is 2.5 years ago. He asked me to come to the Pentagon, and we've had several meetings. And I have great respect for him. And maybe the essence of that is in a speech he gave at the American Legion National Convention in Louisville, Kentucky last August. And this is an excerpt from his speech. And he said, historically, we, meaning the United States, we have been far too arrogant in the world. We need to go out and serve with humility. Historically, the Muslim community is a subtle world that we don't fully and don't always attempt to understand. Only through shared appreciation of the people's cultures, needs, and hopes can we ourselves hope to supplant the extremist narrative. And then Admiral Mullen said, we cannot capture hearts and minds. We must engage them. We must listen to them, one heart, one mind at a time, over time. This is Admiral Mike Mullen, who's our chairman of the U.S. and the United States military. And this is Colonel Kalenda, whose parents are here today. You want to stand up a second? Maybe they were way in the back. Thank you. Thank you. Good Nebraska parents. I can just tell you what education does. But Colonel Kalenda, he's become a good friend. He was, I don't know if his mom's here, I can say all these things, but he was the commander of the forward operating base in Nari in Kunar province in eastern Afghanistan about 3 years ago. He sent me an email, and this is what this is a very volatile area. Several of his men were killed in firefights with the Taliban. And he sent me this email. He said, I am the commander of Task Force Sabre, and I'm in Kunar, Nuristan. And our primary goal is to provide hope for the good people of Afghanistan. Education is one of our top priorities. I am convinced the long-term solution to terrorism is education. The conflict here will not be one with bombs and bullets, but with books and ideas and literacy that excite the imagination towards peace, tolerance, and prosperity. The thirst for education is palpable, and it is education that will make the difference where the next generation grows up to educated patriots or illiterate fighters. The stakes could not be higher. Colonel Christopher Kalenda, he's now up at the Pentagon, and he's... You know, my father, Haji Ali, General Petraeus, they all said, listen. So I try to listen. Sometimes I'm not very successful, but if you could ask any woman in rural Afghanistan or Pakistan, what do you want? And you think most women say, well, I want a good husband, I want a big house, I want prosperity. But you know what most women tell me? please tell me simply two things. They say we don't want our babies to die, and we want our children to go to school. I think the women here, you can relate to that, especially the mothers. Women bring life into the world. It's women that nurture life. And in many ways, women are the really promoters of education in any society. Sometimes I hear Muslim, Christian, Hindu, Buddhist, Jewish, or other leaders say something like, God is on our side. I remember, you know, at South Dakota, before we play UNO, we get on our knees to say a prayer. Now, you're asking for good sportsmanship, but really you're saying, could we just win one more game, please? Anyways, UNO always won, of course. Is that true today? Okay. But you know what? If God is on anybody's side, God is on the side of the widows, the orphans, the refugees, those 128 million children out of school, and all those 68,000 wounded veterans who aren't getting what they need today, who've given their so much for service to our country. And until there's no child, or there's every child in school, until there's no orphans who have love and shelter, until there's no widows who have hope, and until all those kids are in school, until every single one of those 68,000 veterans who've been wounded and maimed in their duty have help they need, none of us here have the right to say God is on our side. And there's still a lot of work that still needs to be done. Well, this is Sakina, Haji Ali's wife. She died in 2001 in the spring. They were quite close, and when I went to Corfe, Haji Ali, we walked up to her grave. She had a very simple grave facing the west towards the sunset. And Haji Ali said, without her, I'm nothing. Very rare to hear a gentleman say that. And then Haji Ali said something I'd never forget. He said, soon you'll be standing here, and I'm going to be in the ground. And he kind of chuckled. And I didn't think it was very funny because, you know, I lost my father and sister, and everyone here, you've lost somebody dear to you. You never, never get over the loss of loved one or friend or family. He said, when that moment happens, Greg, when you stand here, look at me in the ground, you'll be very sad. But I'd like you to do one thing, listen to the wind. And I didn't really understand at the time what he meant. Well, I got back to Corfe in October 2001. I was in Pakistan 3 months before and after 9/11, during a very tumultuous period. And Haji Ali had passed away. So I very painfully walked up to his grave, and there he was in a simple grave, again facing the west towards the sunset. And I stood there, and I was very sad, as he predicted. And I thought, how can I go on? This man had become my mentor, my surrogate father. He told me to sit down and be quiet and drink 3 cups of tea and all those wise lessons. And then I remembered what he said. He said, listen to the wind. So I picked up my eyes and wiped away my tears, and I listened to the wind. And in the wind was the voices of the children in the school. And I realized his legacy and vision had come true for the education of his children. And I thought back to some very precious moments. In the evening, Haji Ali, he loved to read. But he only read 2 books. He read Persian poetry and the Holy Quran. And often, though, he sat on a little charfoy, a little rickety bed, has 4 little raggedy poles. He had thick goggle glasses. But I noticed as he read his 2 precious books, he often seemed sad or he had a tear in his eye. So one day I asked Haji, why are you sad when you read? You know, you're talking about education literacy. He said, Greg, actually, I am illiterate. I cannot read, and I memorize these books. And he showed me how every 4th page, he had flipped the page and put in twigs and piece of paper. He said, it's my life's greatest sadness that I ever learned how to read and write. It's my life's greatest hope that my children and grandchildren can learn to read and write. And then, in his exact words, Haji Ali said, these words in these books make the stories that make wise the fools. And by fools, he meant illiteracy and ignorance. This man, his entire 85 years, he only left his village once to go to Mecca on pilgrimage. He didn't have a phone. He didn't have, I call it twixting, twittering and texting, twixting. He didn't have a fax. He didn't have a newspaper. He didn't have a television. He didn't have a post office. He didn't have any really contact with the outside world. But he knew it was through education was a light for all his people. And that is his message to the universe. It's through education we can have hope. And and a candle for all humanity. Well, life goes on. In the back we have some, you know, all about what we're doing and about the state of education in Afghanistan, Pakistan. And one of the most serendipitous schools that we got started is in Uruzgan province, and it's in Dairaud, which is the ancestral home of Mullah Omar, who was the leader of the Taliban. And 2 years ago, our staff met, and they said, well, it's going to be about 20 years before we get a girls' school going in Uruzgan, and that's about the rate we thought we were going at. Well, just a few months later, last July, the shura, the elders from Dairaud, they said, we want to put a school in our community, girls' school. And I thought they're pulling our leg, but I said, well, you come and visit one of our schools first in Charsiap. So these men came to visit Charsiap School. Now, these men, we don't do a background check on them. You know, I don't know what they've been up to, and they're kind of scary. They're, you know, armed to the teeth and big beards and turbans, and they came to Charsiap School. And again, these are, you know, kind of fierce guys, and I don't know much about them, but they got to Charsiap School, and they saw the giant playground. So they threw down their weapons, and then for an hour and a half, they jumped on the swings and the slides, turbans flying all over the place, and they had a glorious time. And I said, gentlemen, let's get serious. The headmaster's sitting over there patiently waiting for you. We need to look at the curriculum. They said, no, we're totally satisfied. We want a girls' school in our community. So, okay. Then they said, you have to come and have tea with us. So I went there last September, and you know, most Americans don't go wandering around in Uruzgan. I don't know if you go around there. You know, this is not the place to hang out. But I went there. We had a wonderful meeting. At the end of the meeting, said they're ready to build a school. We're going to give free land, free community resources and labor. But you have to have a playground in that school. I said, no problem. Now, my only worry is the school is going to be up and running soon. They're going to use a playground. The girls don't get to use the playground. But seriously, you know, I've spent a lot of time talking deep into the night, these men. Haji Ibrahim on the right, he's the chief, the head of the shura, and Yusuf, Haji Yusuf on the left. And Haji Ibrahim told me as a child, he said, I never had a chance to play. I grew up in refugee camps, in Jalozai. I was taught how to hate, to kill, and to fight my enemies, the Russians and others. And he said, when I saw that playground, I became a child again. He said, you know, and he's now a champion of education in Uruzgan province. And it's rather ironic that the U.S. has dropped thousands of bombs on this province. We've lost many, many troops in this province. We've tried many things. But there is a girls' school in that community because of a playground. We even in the U.S., we have a massive effort now to get kids way down into first grade on the internet and get connected. You know, I don't think kids need to do that. They need to go out and play. They need to have disputes. They need to learn how to get along. Our children, at a very young age, you know, we need to embrace what Mr. Holland is about, early childhood education. We need to, I also think every single child in this country should be bilingual. It doesn't matter what language, but we do live in a global society. Well, I'd like to quote, before that we have a little few questions, with a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. Now, my mom's a good Lutheran. She said, no, Martin Luther said this first. And then I met the Chinese ambassador last year. He said, no, this is an ancient Chinese quote. And in the Hadith, which are part of teaching of Islam, they said, no, this is part of the Hadith. So I don't know who said this first, but it says that even if the world ends tomorrow, I will plant my seed today. And I think if we can listen to our elders, glean and impart their knowledge and wisdom, but then truly believe that children are the road and path to peace, I do think that we can have a better place all around the world. So thank you very much, and God bless you.
You've been listening to a program from the Kaneko Great Minds Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by humanitarian and former mountaineer Greg Mortensen, author of Three Cups of Tea and Stones into Schools. The topic of his talk was Promoting Peace Through Education. Mr. Mortensen's appearance was sponsored by Warren Distribution in partnership with the Phoenix Academy Day School. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, January 14, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The next event in the Kaneko Great Minds series will be Thursday evening, March 31st at 6:30 at the Kaneko Beau Truss, 11th and Jones. The guest speaker will be June Kaneko, making his first public appearance at the cultural organization which bears his name. His topic will be Kaneko on Stage, a public presentation on opera design. Special thanks to Heike Langdon, Kaneko Events and Community Relations Manager, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Special thanks also to sound engineer Rick Weiner for his assistance in the recording of this program. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.